The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia, and thank you very much for joining us. I'm Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guests. Hanya Yanagihara's best-selling second novel, A Little Life, is a tragic and transcendent parable of adulthood and an unsettling meditation on abuse and the depths of human cruelty, offset by the restorative powers of friendship. A National Book Award finalist and shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, it was named to dozens of publications' Best Books of the Year lists. Her previous book, The People in the Trees, was shortlisted for the Penn Robert W. Bingham Prize for Debut Fiction. She's also editor-in-chief at T Magazine, the New York Times style magazine. Her new novel, To Paradise, is a story about the deep recesses of the human heart, and follows three sets of characters navigating alternate realities that reveal frightening implications for our own lives. This evening, she'll be joined in conversation with Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Please join me in welcoming our guests to the Free Library.
I'm so happy to be back in Philadelphia with Andy, and thank you so much for coming out on this balmy evening. I mean, it's very cold.
It's balmy.
I don't know what happened.
It's really balmy.
Yeah. I'm from Hawaii, so this feels very familiar, you know?
Thank you so much for coming back to join us at the library. It's been
thrilled to be here.
7 years?
Yeah, I think so. I think six.
March 2016,
yeah.
So yeah, six.
Yeah, according to math, yes.
Paperback, all right, math, yeah. All right, well.
Not why any of us are here.
We'll go with it, though. I would say that 5 or 6 years ago, I'd have thought that this book was pure fiction, but to me, part of the power of this story is that it feels like a possible template for the future. And that's due to your remarkable artistry and imagination. The book is epic, yet intimate, brutal, yet deeply loving, strange, yet familiar. Hanya, you've done it again.
Thanks, Andy. Thank you.
Now, I know you're all receiving copies of the book. Have any of you read it? Not during the 20 minutes you were waiting, but prior to coming here?
Wow.
Okay.
One person in the back.
All right. Well, we're not going to spoil anything for everyone else, just so you know. So we're going to fly at a bird's eye view here pretty high and just sort of touch on themes, writing, structure, that sort of thing. How does that sound to you?
That sounds great.
That's good, because that's what I planned. In the acknowledgments, you remark on your perspective-altering conversations with your editor and friend, and I believe his name is Karsten Kredl.
Yes.
Are you willing to tell us something about those exchanges and how they affected your thinking about the book?
Wow, this is such a great first question. It's not the first question I usually get. So, Karsten is my German editor, and the way it typically works, if any of you are authors or aspiring authors, is that if you're lucky enough, the US editor buys the book, maybe a British editor buys it, and then a couple of foreign publishers, and whoever gets there first gives you editorial notes. The old saw is that the British don't edit, and they really don't. I mean, they do very, very light editing. Americans edit quite a bit, and then the Germans do edit quite a bit too. So when I was in Germany doing this tour for A Little Life in German, Karsten and I would take these long train rides back and forth across the country, and he had two little children at the time. This is 2017. And he has he's a very ethical person. You know, he stopped flying altogether sometime in the past couple of years because as a symbolic gesture to help prevent climate change. And he actively worries, his kids are 5 and 2, about what's going to happen, what kind of world he's leaving for his children. You know, Karsten grew up in East Germany, he grew up behind the wall, He grew up in, you know, we're the same age, and we grew up obviously in, with very different understandings of what freedom was and what autonomy is and what our future could be. You know, his was prescribed to him, and it was dangerous for him to try to be ambitious, and mine was very different. But I really did begin thinking over the course of those conversations about this idea, and I think all of us think about this if we have young people in our lives, and that's almost all of us, about, you know, what is this world that we are leaving to our children? How much does society owe an individual, and how much does an individual owe society? You know, at what point does the government have to step in and try to make things better for the whole, for the many, rather than for the few? I mean, these were the promises of Eastern Germany when Carson was growing up that, of course, didn't come to fruition. But it was a different way of thinking about a society. And as I talked to him, I started thinking more and more about these questions, which eventually became this book.
Yeah, a lot of those questions and a lot of those themes pervade every aspect of the book. I'm wondering if with, as you did with A Little Life, with you, if you also had a series of images in mind to follow along with or to...
Not as much. This was a less visual book than A Little Life was. And I think partly because A Little Life was so internal and there are no time, there's no time in the book. You know, there's no dates, there's no major historic events. When you are creating a book that is three different worlds, as this book is, one of which is our world and two of which are invented worlds, you do, I think you're less dependent upon imagery in a sense because you have time, you have dates, you're inventing them. You're inventing these historical events. You're inventing the way and how people move through time. But in a way, it's less of an act of world creation than when time is taken out of the equation altogether and you want something very fairy tale-like. You know, I listened to a lot of music when I was writing this, especially in the second part of the book, which is set in Hawaii. And there are, you know, is anyone, by the way, here from Hawaii? Oh, you are. So, okay, so you'll know that, did you know the song? Well, you haven't read it yet. So there are three songs that are in the book that you'll, two songs in the book and one that that the character's name is based on. And you'll understand it if you're from Hawaii. And there's a lot of moments, I think, in the book like that, where if you were raised in one kind of America, you will understand the cues and the allusions. And if you don't come from that America and you miss it, it should read, you know, it should be as fulfilling. But, you know, my fellow Kama'aina, you'll know that the last names of the characters, Bishop, Bingham, Griffith, and Cook, are all the names of great missionary families from America who came to the islands in the 19th century and settled there. You know, there's a mention in part three of the book about the relocation centers where the sick get sent, and those are named, those are, you know, Japanese-American internment camps, Heart Mountain, Jerome, you know, Post and Gila River, and so on and so forth. So depending on what kind of America you were raised in, you will see or not see different things in this narrative, which is began as an answer to your question, but then went way off track.
Yeah, no, that's fine. That segues perfectly into something I have here, which is, and I think it will help expose some of the structure. If you could talk about the Davids, the Charles, the Edwards, maybe even the Nathaniels, and it seems like their naming also helped structure the book in a way. I mean, it seemed like it could have gone either way,
right,
depending on how you chose to write it, but...
Yeah. So there are, as I said, there's three different parts of the book, one set in 1893, in which New York is part of a country within a country called the Free States. Pennsylvania is part of that, the Free States as well. Then there's 1993, which is our world. It's set in a recognizable New York. And then 2093, in which America is sliding towards totalitarianism. And in each book, the names repeat. So there's three main characters, David, Charles, and Edward. And then a number of secondary and tertiary characters, Nathaniel, as Andy mentioned, Eden, Eliza, all of those names repeat too. And you know, there are certain things that don't really become clear to you until after you finish your third book. And one of the things that became clear to me was that, you know, I think for some reasons that I understand and other reasons I don't, there's always a character in one of the books who is uncomfortable with his or her name, where the act of naming someone or renaming someone becomes important and freighted with meaning. And I had this idea that was kind of fanciful that, you know, we think of ourselves as shaping history and shaping society, but what if it were the opposite? What if we remained the same and society shaped us? So there was only a finite number of people and personalities, and then a multitude of societies rather than the other way around. And you know, the effect is meant to be a little jarring, but this book asks the reader to do some work, and it also asks her to surrender in a way to the rhythms of the book, to its internal logic, and to its world creation. And I hope that when readers do enter this book, part of what they consider is why the characters are named, what they are, and how those what those names are meant to signify as well.
Well, maybe we can talk about that a little bit, because there seem to be types that are associated with the character names. So Davids, to me, tended to be dreamers, feel isolated, and perhaps a little invalided for various reasons. Charleses tended to be institutional players, lawyer, business owner, scientist. Edwards, to move like their last names in chess, the bishop, which goes at a none of this is right, right?
It's a really good theory, Andy, and I might take it. But yeah, I mean, the Edwards did end up, well, no, it's a good theory. I mean, the Edwards, I was slightly worried by the end. I thought, the Edwards aren't meant to be jerks. They're the slipperiest of the characters. But, you know, there's no particular significance to the names themselves, except for David, who is in part named after the last king of Hawaii, Kavika, whose name appears in the book as well. That's the Hawaiianization of David. It's a good theory, though.
Yeah, I didn't
I've
even
heard
get...
worse.
You have.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
There's
yeah.
worse. I didn't there even is. Get to mention my bishop theory was that character... God, to hell with it.
No, but I think it's good. I mean, you never know. I may have to use it at some point.
Can you talk about the use of the fantasiecle frame for each chapter?
So, you know, a fantasiecle is an end of century book, and it usually refers, or usually a book, and it refers to the end of the 19th century. And one of my editors put it very well. You know, well, first of all, it was when you look at novels from that period, they're full of dread. I mean, you know, humans, of course, can't help but think that the end of a century is going to mean some sort of great change. And sometimes it does, but it's never the sort of change that we think. I mean, if you think about the sort of expectations and neuroses around Y2K, and some of you aren't old enough to remember this, but for those of us who were, there was this real sense that at the stroke of midnight, and as silly as this sounds, things would suddenly feel very different. And there was certainly that feeling at the end of the 19th century. Modernity was creeping ever closer, and I think there was probably a very visceral sense that one era was ending and another was beginning. And, you know, but one of my editors put it very well. She said that the book says basically the war isn't over after all, which I thought was a very nice way of putting it. That one of the things that I think this book suggests is that, you know, time itself, you know, time might be an arrow, but history is a helix, and it goes around and around and around. And we associate great change with the end of centuries, but of course there's no, you know, real scientific basis to that.
The last time you were here, you'd mentioned that you'd written A Little Life with a Sense of Urgency to talk about certain topics of loneliness and love.
Right.
And I wonder if there was that urgency in creating this, because it's such a big world and traverses so much time. But at the same time, in a way, it doesn't. Like the first part, it's 4 months or so. Second part is it a month?
Well, the second part is divided into two parts.
Right.
The first part's set in a single night,
right.
And the second part is set over actually, you know, several decades over a period of the second David's father's life, also named David.
So was there an urgency to this book or not with the way that there was to A Little Life?
Yeah, I mean, there very much was. It was a different kind of urgency. I began thinking about what would become this book in 2016, and it was pretty embryonic then. By 2017, I think if there was really a spark, it was after the Muslim ban, and I was, you know, I think like so many of us, was watching the scenes unfold at U.S. airports, and you had the sense that you were watching some sort of paradigm, not just shift, but rewrite itself in real time. And of course, that's always happening. You know, history is always being made, and America's always changing. But I think it was the understanding that so much of what we consider to be law in this country is in fact not law, it's tradition, or it's politesse, or it's something that it's ritual. And to watch those things change, to watch them be upended so quickly, it wasn't just the act itself, it was the speed with which it was happening. And, you know, I felt, I think, you know, horrified, like many of us. And I also felt, I think, like many of us, quite helpless. You know, I think the first instinct is to narrativize crises, and yet none of us were able to quite do it. You know, you heard people just say again and again, I don't know what to say, which I thought was as good a statement about what was happening as any, that things, history was happening too fast for us to put into words. You know, because I work at the New York Times, I'm technically not allowed to express any political views anywhere. I can't, you know, I'm you know, you're technically not allowed to say it at dinner parties what you really think. And, you know, not only did I feel that no one wanted to hear it anyway, and not only was I not quite sure what I wanted to say, but it felt premature to try to put language to something that was felt so present tense. But I did know that I could save it for fiction, and that's what I did. And that, to me, was really the urgency of the book. It was understanding that this was a change in America unlike previous changes, at least in my lifetime, and that things were not going to be the same again, even if I was able to articulate it to myself at the time.
So then which part of the book did you start, given that response?
It was more this idea that, you know, I started thinking more actively about this idea of paradise being the operating metaphor that we use for America, and what if that was wrong all along? You know, I mean, paradise traditionally means a walled garden, and a walled garden is supposed to keep people out, not let people in. And so had the central fiction, the central romance of America been wrong all along? I mean, certainly for a lot of people it always was wrong, but had we been telling ourselves the wrong kind of fiction about this country?
Where did you land?
You know, I think I'm going to back into this answer. I think one of the questions that this book asks, you know, and I'm sure Andy will ask about the third part of the book, which is set in an age of serial pandemics. But to me, one of the eerier things that it managed to predict was the conversations that we're having on a mass scale about American history, who gets to tell it, who gets to be written into it, and what it is. And you have, and more importantly, you know, what is this country? Is it a country that whose best days are behind it? Is it a country that can is headed towards a different kind of greatness? Is it a country that is deeply flawed but can be fixed within the systems that exist? Or is it a country that is so elementally damaged that it has to be burned down and started again? And those questions, you know, have I think some of us have always been asking them, but the number of people who are having this conversation about how do we see this country has grown, I think, faster than perhaps before in human history, or at least, I'm sorry, in the history of this country. You know, I don't know. I think depending on the hour of the day you ask me, I would say, you know, that it's a damaged country that can be fixed, or I would say that it's a flawed country that can't. And again, this is a question that all of us are asking. For many of us whose ancestors chose to come here, America not only was a paradise, but is a paradise. I mean, for my ancestors who came in the late 19th century and had opportunities that they wouldn't have had, you know, I mean, the problem with the myth of paradise is that it's not entirely wrong for many people.
I'm not even sure where to go after that, except that it seems like there's an attitude to burn it down. I'm hearing that more and more and seeing that more and more. And I'm finding it particularly distressing, since I have kids, that my kids feel that way.
Yeah.
And it's theirs to win or lose or keep or trash.
I think part of it is that we're such a young country. I mean, it's a young country made up of old cultures, right? And when you are a young country, you know, when you talk to your friends from older cultures, you know, I think they see us very much like sort of spoil precocious children. So all of the great qualities of a young, smart child, you know, the generosity, the inquisitiveness, the curiosity, the energy, the goodwill, and then, you know, spoiledness, the temper tantrums, the short-temperedness, you know, the short attention span, the incuriosity at the same time. I think that that's what animates a lot of what this country is, and I'm very much an American. I say this as someone who is, I think, blessed and guilty of all of those things. But, you know, I do think that, well, I forgot what the question was and where I was going with this, but you know, I do think that it is something, oh, I remember where I was going with this. I remember when I was in high school, this was 1992, and it was shortly after Tiananmen, and I was talking to my best friend's mother, who was from mainland China. And I had just learned, we had just been learning about the Cultural Revolution in school, and I was telling her how sad I thought it, devastating I thought it was. And she said, and I'll never forget this, she said, yes, but the communists have only been in control for 50 years, and China's 5,000 years old. And it was such a different way about thinking about time and history that to her, this was a blip. It was, you know, not even, it was 1% of their history. And things would change and the country would become something else and the communists were here for now, but they wouldn't be there forever. And I think in America, that's something we have a hard time remembering, that, you know, countries survive many things and they are constantly changing.
Yeah, I guess the big question is, can we survive this thing? And that, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, traditionally, you know, democracies don't last for more than 250, 300 years, and then they change and become something else. And I think a lot of us feel the anxiety, again, across the political spectrum, of wondering what we're going to become.
Well, and I was saying earlier, the third part of the novel, I didn't specifically reference it, just seems to be something of a template for where we're headed in terms of information control, pandemic control. I don't want to get too specific here, but this creeping fascism and this capacity to lose democracy one inch at a time so that all of a sudden it's gone.
I do understand, you know, I think that, I mean, of course, the response to COVID and how we think about the disease and how we react to it is inseparable now from politics and has become linked with so many other political conversations we're having in the United States. But at the core of that, there are real questions. You know, specifically, how much of our civil liberties should we be giving up in the name of safety? When does too much become too much? Is it truly possible to protect ourselves? And I don't just mean masks or no masks, but look at what happened after 9/11. I mean, this idea that when a country tries to do everything it can to protect itself, what is it giving up? And I make no judgments here. I mean, I'm not sure what the answers are, but there's some, I think, decisions from 9/11 that we've grown collectively as a nation, or some of us at least, to regret, and others we accept in the name of personal safety. And that question, you know, and it reflects itself in this book between parent and child, between grandparent and child, between society and individual, of what we will do, what we will forsake, which of our fellow citizen civil liberties will we forsake to protect ourselves, I think is one that we all think about now.
And we see in the third part, Charles is one of the characters who's most strongly dealing with that. And I assume it was your intention to make us empathetic to Charles and Charles's perspective on things, and I was shocked to see that I was willing to go down the road with Charles, because it is his head we're in, and he makes a lot of rational decisions that seem to be logical, and everything he does, there's blowback, and he, along with one other character, bear the brunt of their own.
Right.
Their own decisions more than anybody else, it seems, at least in the third part.
Yes, so Charles in the third part is a scientist, this won't give away anything, who becomes a government functionary, and is a high-ranking government functionary, who makes certain decisions for the nation about how the government should be controlling illness. And a lot of those decisions he comes to regret. And I'm always interested in this phrase that we've started throwing around a lot about people being on the wrong side of history. Now, sometimes it's very easy to tell who's on the wrong side of history and why, because those decisions are born out of bigotry or cruelty. But often they're not. And I think especially when it comes to science, it's very, very hard. I think that, you know, you can look at any major moment in modern science, whether it was the H-bomb or whether it was, you know, the response to previous pandemics, and you can see bad actors, but you can also see well-intentioned people who made the wrong mistakes, who made the wrong decisions, and which were only revealed to be wrong in time. But this idea that you always know, that you can always look through the future's lens back at history is not true. And I was, you know, I wanted to write somebody who did act in good faith and tried to do what he did think was going to be best for his country.
Or do you truck with Charles's ideas?
Well, certain of them. You know, I mean, I grew up in a family of scientists and people who with a public health training, and I think, you know, people who have MPHs or epidemiologists are making these kinds of hard decisions all the time. You know, I mean, science is not devoid from politics. I mean, anyone who, you know, you have to only look at the AIDS pandemic for that to see how, you know, how callously many of the early, you know, the earliest victims of AIDS were treated by the scientific establishment and by the government. I mean, you know, scientists are individuals and swayed by politics and as much as anything else. But I also think that, you know, if you are a master, if you are an epidemiologist or an officer of public health, you are really trying to balance, I think, constantly citizens' rights with the safety of the many and while also understanding that you don't quite know what's going on. And assuming that people are acting in good faith, they're still going to make, you know, the decisions that they will grow to, you know, to regret or that will turn out to be incorrect. I mean, there's just no way around it, I think.
Yeah, and what you do so wonderfully in the book is you take it and it not only is it political, but it is, as you said earlier, it affects personal relationships,
right,
of a parent and child, and then trajects through a family for generations.
Right.
Yeah, it's very powerful. I wonder if you could talk about the uses of technology and how, vis-a-vis the pandemic in the third section, because it's salient and it's familiar.
Well, you know, when you're writing a dystopian novel, you kind of have two choices. You can make it very high-tech or very low-tech. And you know, I made it very low tech for a few reasons. It felt to me, so it's kind, this city state is sort of modeled on, not the city state, the country is sort of modeled on Turkmenistan in the sense that they have they have high tech capabilities, but they have chosen to let the population live in a pretty pre-technological world. So phones don't exist, the internet doesn't exist, TV doesn't exist. The population knows about it. They know it once existed. They just don't have access to it. Of course, other people do have access to it. The high-ranking scientists do, the state officials do, and so on and so forth. But the other thing about writing about technology is that it's just not satisfying, I feel, to read. You know, when I was writing A Little Life, there's very little texting, as you notice in that book. People still do make phone calls. It's a warmer form of technology. I just think that unless you really need it to prove a point, and sometimes you do, it is not enjoyable to read about technology so much, or at least for me. But I also did think that one of the ways that a government can control its people, and we see this in real life, of course, is by starving them of information. And the easiest way you do that is by taking away their access to information.
And it's a group of people who have the idea that to flip that is the way to somehow democratize things again.
Yes. Yes.
We won't say how that turns out. I wonder if we flip back to the earlier section, you see the idea of servants as a sort of early surveillance technology in a way.
Yeah, that's good.
That sort of makes sense.
Yeah, that's true.
I wonder if we could move to, and it's a major theme of the book, and maybe I just touched on it enough, but this limit of, the limits of parental love. Mm. And in the third part of the book, something that really struck me was when Charles says of Charlie, "All I want for her is the ability to tell her story." And it's a line in the middle of a paragraph that's easy to gloss over, but it seems like it's how we know who we are, and we don't know, if we can't tell our story, then we can't know what love is at all. And this is what Charles wants to share with Charlie in the most profound way. I mean, what do you think of that idea? Because it seems you were nudging towards something like that with that sentence.
I think the actual line is, "Sorry, Annie, to tell herself a story." And that, to me, it's similar but a little different, because one of the things that the three sort of main characters of these books, so David in the first, David in the second, and Charlie in the third, really struggle with is this idea of narrating their life to themselves. And it's not because they don't have desires to be loved or to love somebody else or to have affection. It's because they don't necessarily know how to ask for it or communicate it in a way that other people can understand. And that, I think, is the most isolating thing for any of us. And it is why we continue to find resonance in narrative literature, you know, from centuries ago, because, you know, all narrative literature is about that quest. It's about the fundamental human desire, you know, to love and to be loved and to find affection. And in this book, you know, one of the things that I hope, I'm glad that you mentioned parents, Andy, because if A Little Life was about expanding the definition of what was a life-sustaining relationship, about what a friendship was, I think one of the things I hope this book does is suggest that the act of parenting could be as simple as, you know, an older person taking care of a younger person. And yet, of course, even then you run into problems. At what point does taking care of move into something more oppressive? What do we, you know, how much autonomy can we be generous enough to allow the people that we care about? And all of the characters, to different extent, struggle with that, and all of the older characters sometimes wield their love and their protectiveness like a weapon.
And that sort of segues, at least in my mind, to this idea of home, which changes throughout the novel. It's sort of, at least the way I was reading it, it is like a parent's love. Home can represent both sanctuary and oppression. Mm. And I wonder if that, how the meaning of home evolved for you over the arc of the novel.
Well, there's the literal home, you know, so there's the house on Washington Square in which all of the characters live or spend part of their time. And then there's this idea of home as belonging or home as another person or home as a society that accepts you or home simply feeling that you are a productive citizen or member of society, whatever that means. And all of those competing ideas of home, you know, the immigrant's home, the refugee's home, the escapee's home, the native's home, I hope, you know, double back upon themselves again and again many times in this book.
You mentioned the characters looking toward other characters, and there seems to be a type in this novel. It was sort of in A Little Life, sort of an invalided male, a person who just wants to be cared for but also has some deep emotional wound that literally incapacitates them for some period of time. And I wondered if you were looking at earlier novels of manners or things of that sort, and just sort of flipping the script on Austin and James and Wharton, and because that's a role that's typically assigned to a woman in earlier writing. And you just kind of transvalue everything in that first section, and it works so well.
You know, well, thank you, but it's not supposed to necessarily be a gender swap, although I will say, so in the first part of the book, which is a retelling of Henry James's Washington Square, which, have a lot of you read that? Do people read James anymore? Okay, so not many people. This is very interesting. When I was in the UK, no one had read him, which, you know, they have other people of their own to read, but I was still kind of shocked. So Washington Square was, I think, 1883 or two. It was James's least favorite of his works. Someone's nodding. It's a novella, and it's, if any of you are sort of scared of James, this is by far his most accessible book. And it's a very simple story. It's about a young woman named Catherine Sloper who lives with her father, Dr. Sloper, who's rich, I mean, but the money's from her dead mother. And she falls in love with a man who her father and aunt are convinced is a grifter, and she wants to be with. And the father threatens to disown her, and she has a decision to make. And, you know, it is almost, you know, potboilery, given what Henry James usually wrote. And Dr. Sloper is such a cruel character, but also there's something elemental in him, that he's blunt, and he doesn't sway from his word. And one of the things that I found so chilling about that book was that it suggested, I think, in a way that was unusual for its time, that a parental love was not inviolable, that a parent could choose not to love his child, as Dr. Sloper probably doesn't. So when I was retelling this story, I was thinking a lot about the marriage novel. And of course, the marriage novel, in almost every narrative tradition, is you know, a beloved genre. I mean, it's Jane Austen, but of course, it's also, you know, Flaubert, it's Tanizaki, it's so many different people have done a marriage novel. And of course, the marriage novel is basically a novel about money, as almost all novels are. And they're about money because a woman's choices, her opportunities, were always determined by how much money she had or how much money she could marry into. And I did think, what if marriage wasn't gendered like that? What would a marriage story be? And then beyond that, if America hadn't been founded on Puritanism, if it came from a different sort of ideology or philosophy, what would marriage be? And what would gender roles be in such a country? And things changed relatively quickly. Now, in this version of America, the free states, the fact that they don't adhere to Puritan traditions doesn't mean that they're not racist. I mean, they don't want black citizens, they don't want Native Americans, and they don't particularly want Jews either. But it did mean that, which is also a reminder that, you know, one form of progress is not necessarily progress across the board, and that you can have complicated people who you can admire certain parts of the society and revile others. But also within that, if men didn't have to be masculine in a sense, in the same sense, if they didn't have to be providers, if they didn't have to be, you know, emotionally stoic, they would be different people. The society would be different. You would have people who could, in a sense, have the privilege to be weak. And it was, it seemed like a very natural outgrowth of this kind of society.
Yeah, it worked. It just surprised me in a way. I thought, how come this hasn't been written about in this way before? Mm. And I just want to follow up. Has it been? Were there any novels apart from James's more heteronormative narrative that you could look to that were queer, that were 19th century novels?
No, I mean, I love Sarah Waters' books. They're not exactly what I drew from. I mean, I did draw a lot from Michael Cunningham's Specimen Days, not in a way that I think is recognizable to readers necessarily, but this is the book After the Hours. It's my favorite of his novels. And it's a tripartite book as well. And there's a part with this lizard-like creature who's a nanny to a young human charge. She's in Central Park, and she's such a beautiful character because it really is about the human and the alien. But after I sent this book to Michael, who I know a little and is a really great guy, he made a really interesting point, which I never really thought of, and he said, I don't know why writers are so loyal to history, which I thought was a really interesting way of putting it. That he said, I don't know why they're so faithful, why they don't feel that it's theirs to upend and twist and discard and do with what they want. It happens in genre writing all the time, of course, but it doesn't happen that often in straight fiction. And I'm not sure why, I never thought about it that way, that writers were loyal to history, but I guess we are, more so than one would think.
I guess it's easier to have that structure to work within. And
I guess so, although playwrights aren't as beholden. I think if you look at someone like Tony Kushner, and this book is definitely in conversation with Angels in America, I think that he's very playful with history. I'm not thinking of any of them at the moment, of course, but Luke Snath. I mean, I think a lot of people, George C. Wolfe, really, a lot of playwrights really are very, allow themselves to change history in a way that suits their narrative and in a way that perhaps fiction writers aren't.
Do you think it's just that the form permits it, you know, because it's a complete story, but it's a shorter form?
I think so, but I also think playwrights are in general more irreverent. God.
All you playwrights.
Yeah. I mean, they're the best. Playwrights are the best kind of writers. If you ever need to make writer friends, just hang out with playwrights. I do.
Doesn't the, we had Michael here for Specimen Days. Isn't that the one that has, there's a Whitman narrative in that as well?
Yeah, there's a Whitman narrative, and there's the Triangle Shirtwaist factory fire. That's the first part, yeah.
Well, those are, yeah. Okay. A couple more questions, and then we'll throw it open to the audience. Right.
You guys are such a good audience. Aren't you hot? It's really hot in here.
It's really hot. Is it hot out there? It's hot up here.
It's really hot. No. I know you guys are all wearing coats.
Oh, I can see the air conditioner's off.
Oh, it's a little chilly out there.
It was. I put my jacket on.
Oh. Okay, thanks for letting me know. It's really hot up here. I thought it was just me.
Have a glass of water.
I know, it's not helping.
You know, I actually don't have anything more
That's
planned.
It, huh?
Well, I do, but
it's all spoiler rich.
Yeah, it's just I have a feeling the audience will ask more interesting things. So why don't we throw it open to you folks?
Okay.
Those of you who have mics, Charlotte, Dave, if you could come on down. If you'd raise your hand, we'll get a microphone to you. Who'd like to start us off?
My question is, of the three books that you've written, which was your favorite to write and why?
Definitely not the first. A Little Life was fastest, but it was the hardest emotionally. This one I felt pretty good about it. You know, I felt that I paced myself well, I knew what I was doing. I mean, there was that constant same mix of, you know, of hubris and self-hatred. But, you know, part of it is just, you just learn how to do it. I mean, you just get better at actually working around and anticipating your weaknesses as a writer. And so, and a lot of that involves time and procrastinating and slacking off and so on and so forth. So this one was the easiest to do. Was that the other part? Did you ask which one I liked the most?
Actually, that was a question I had, but
yeah.
I'll go with like, which one did you like writing?
Right, that's good. I mean, they're very different books. You know, I think I live the most with A Little Life simply because I get asked about it the most. I really do love this book, though. I think that it's a different book, but I think that it has a lot of emotional and thematic echoes.
It's to my understanding, at least, that you had a lot of input on the cover design for A Little Life.
Yeah.
Are you able to speak on the cover design for this book?
Yes. So the painting is by a Dutch painter named Hubert Vos. And when I was talking to the art director about it, we knew that I intentionally didn't want, I mean, I don't know if you've been in your local bookstore lately, but it's a lot of very bright colors and a lot of alt text and a lot of graphic, and I didn't want that. I wanted something that felt out of time, that felt unplaceable. I knew this artist's work because at the Honolulu Museum of Art, there's a picture, a painting that he did around the same time. This is from 1898, I think. And it's of a Paniolo, a Hawaiian cowboy, and the kingdom brought over cowboys from Mexico and Puerto Rico to train Hawaiians how to be cowboys, and so it's of a local Hawaiian cowboy playing an ukulele. So I knew he had been to Hawaii before, and I thought he might have some other paintings, which he did. This one is called Iokepa, Hawaiian Fisher Boy, and I love the expression in his eyes. It almost looks like he's looking towards the future and doesn't like what he's seeing. But it's just what made it modern to me was that expression, that little furrow between his eyes, almost as if he could see that the world was in trouble, and it felt like the right thing for the book. And then the designer very beautifully laid To Paradise across his neck, almost like a lei. So there's little gestures towards Hawaii, which, you know, which is relevant to the book on this cover. Thank you.
And I love the little squids on the front. It took me a while to figure out what they were.
Yeah,
so is that what they are?
Well, oh yeah, I didn't even notice that. Well, so what you have to, when you, you know, I don't know how many of you are writers, but this is how you can tell when a house is scared of you and is paying a lot of money on the cover. Gold foil, neon Pantone, more gold foil, more gold foil, and printed end papers. But I wanted to, you know, to really be an object that, that you could hold and spend some time with.
So the squids weren't your idea?
No.
Another question, please.
So this is a question that I want to ask every author that I've read multiple works from.
Yeah.
When writing your books, did you see them as standalones, or were you writing with in mind having deep connections between the books?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think there's thematic connections. To me, the unifying theme is shame. And I think that I'm not one of those people, you know, like a David Mitchell, who I think thinks of his books as one entire book that happened to be sectioned into parts. Or Ishiguro, Kazuo Ishiguro, who has, you know, two themes, history and memory. And then in each book, he reconstructs the book around those themes. I mean, it's very, very hard to do, I think, to have be so disciplined in the themes that you're exploring and yet create completely different universes around them. I think the books are linked thematically. As I said, there's shame and there's loneliness. And those, to me, are the things that keep coming up again and again and again. These people who, in all of the books, feel somehow, not just that they're outside of society, but society's left them behind. And what does that do to a person, and how does that anger shape itself and manifest itself? It's a good question to ask everyone, though.
How do you write against writing something that you've written about before, in a way, that theme appears, and so, oh, I don't want to do that with, I need to make it a little different this time?
I think it's just because you never know the answer. You know, I mean, I always say that, you know, if you go into a novel, you should have a lot of questions, and if you've done it right, by the time you're finished, you have the answers to none of them, and you have a lot more. But the idea of personal shame is so different in all of us. You know, I mean, there's overlap, and there's I think things that we'd all find recognizable in our own expressions of shame. But much of it is so different that the books can't help but be different either, I think.
Okay. I just want to ask you about the idea of reincarnation in the books, because the characters come back in different time, as different setting, but they all share the same names, same gender. I was wondering if you deliberately do that, including some Eastern philosophies or Buddhism ideas about humans are never done with their suffering, they just keep coming back and deal with it.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. I mean, they actually don't come back. They're distinct characters, and so they're not linked. I can understand, people have read them as linked, which I think is interesting, but they actually aren't related. I mean, to me, one of the best books about, you know, novelistic reincarnation is Life After Life. Have you read that by Kate Atkinson? I mean, I think that's a really beautiful and very well done book about, you know, someone who, you know, the protagonist keeps dying and coming back and dying, coming back, dying, coming back. Because these are three separate worlds, they're actually not the same people coming back again and again and again. But it's a very fun literary conceit that is very hard to pull off. So if you're a writer, I hope you try it, because it was too hard for me to do. You know? Yeah, did everyone hear the question? So it's about pandemics, and the third part of the book is about a pandemic, and where was I in the writing when COVID came up? I was deep into the third part of the book. You know, I started researching it the pandemic part of the book in 2017. And I went up to Rockefeller University, which where a lot of that section of the book is set. And it's a biological sciences postgraduate university on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And I met with some virologists, and one of them, who was this terrifying French guy, said, there's another one coming. And, he sounded sort of excited, and but his whole point is there's been too much money given to cancer research and not enough to virology. But by the time we were all sent home, I think I got sent home from the office on March 13th of 2020, I was more than halfway through that part of the book, and I knew exactly what was going to happen at the end, and very little changed. You know, in the life of this book, of the 2093 New York, COVID doesn't exist. When you're reading it, you'll notice that there's one point in which Charles, the scientist, is listing off the previous century's major illnesses, and COVID's not one of them. There are many others, though, that he lists off. But it changed very little about how the universe I constructed. What did change a little bit was climate change. And originally, for that section of the book, which is set in 2093, I had this idea that it would be set in some kind of nuclear winter, you know, that everything had gotten so hot that hell had frozen over. And then I realized it wasn't that far away, and we would still be in the middle of incredible heat. And so one of the things that marks these characters' lives and also exacerbates the spread of illness is the heat. And that I made some changes on, but not the disease itself.
Hi.
Hi.
There's been a lot of ink spilled about your status as one of the most prominent writers of gay male stories, particularly in America recently. I guess my question would be, how do you feel about that debate, so to speak, and whether you sort of embrace that mantle or reject it?
Well, I I've never claimed, and I would never claim to represent any kind of group. You know, not my own, not certainly not somebody else's. The only thing I can say is I've been very honored and very flattered that other people, other kinds of people who are not, from my identity group, or I am not of theirs, have seen themselves in these books. But I would never presume to say that I speak for anybody. We ran, at the magazine I work at, we ran a great story about Tony Kushner in December, this past December, in which he said, and I'm going to paraphrase him badly, but he said it much more eloquently than I did. And he was talking about writing West Side Story, the West Side Story movie script. And he said, I really resist the idea that writing in a different identity is somehow doing harm to that group. He said, one of the great things that art can offer us and that artists can offer us in this period is empathic flights into another's life. And I think sometimes when you are writing in the skin of another, you can examine in a way the particular perils and also pleasures of being an outsider in the country in a way that is harder to see when you're trying to write from your own, superficial experience. I guess it's my long way of saying that, I make no claims to anybody, and I think it's the pleasure of every fiction writer to try to write all sorts of people into history and an imagined history. And I can't be the only person writing gay characters into an imagined American past, and I hope it won't be the last.
Out of all the characters you've written, which do you relate to the most?
I mean, the short answer is all of them, which I know is an unsatisfying answer, but you really have to. I mean, you have to love these people. You're spending a lot of time with them. I think a reader always knows when a writer has disdain for her or contempt for a character, and the reader will never have any sort of sympathy for the character who feels like the writer's holding her nose while writing her. But I guess, mean, it's, I really loved writing Charlie in the third part of this book. She's the first time I've written a female protagonist, and her voice came to me very fast. And I felt a lot of sympathy for her and also a lot of admiration for her.
There's somebody off to the right here, but before we go to that person, Charlie. Charlie, wow, Charlie. Did you, when you were writing Charlie's character, it just seemed like a tough character to write because we are going through whatever Charlie's going through. So you were withholding information all along the way on us.
You know, this is one of the two protagonists in the third part of the book, and she's affectless, but I didn't want people to try to diagnose her. I didn't want her to label her, or try to name her condition. She is in many ways, from a novelistic perspective, the ideal narrator because she observes closely, but a lot of nuance escapes her, and she's very accepting. She accepts the life she lives in, she accepts the world she lives in, and she is resigned, which is not to say that she's not spiritless, but that she has learned that, in a way, I suppose, like Karsten, my editor, at the top of this conversation, that the best way to survive in the world she's in is by not hoping for too much. And that's a very satisfying character to write, I think.
Hi, thank you so much for coming. I loved your first two books. I'm excited to read this one.
Thank you.
I'm here with a friend, and we both have a question, so I hope you don't mind asking too.
Yeah.
But my friend's question is why you write so few female main characters. And my question is about why you seem to return to or explore a subject that many people and authors don't want to turn to, which is trauma, and specifically abuse, child abuse, caretaker abuse, and why that's a theme in the past two books, and I'm not sure if it's in this one as well. Thank you.
Thank you. This book is 100% child abuse free. happy to say, yeah. But I am interested in, I'll answer your friend's question first. I don't really know, except that, how to put this, being a woman and exploring women's lives has never been a particular interest to me from a literary perspective. And I think it's because I feel I have never had any, well, I've outgrown any sort of anxiety I felt about laying claim to womanhood. And so I think that it was never something I was interested for whatever reason. I mean, these are the sort of great questions where you wish you had a psychologist on stage with you. You know, you could answer them for you.
I play one at work.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, where's Lucy with her psychiatric help 5 cents sign? But it just never, for whatever reason, it never particularly interested me on the page. I enjoy reading about it, but I don't feel the need to write about it. In terms of trauma, I think one of the things I am really interested in besides shame is this idea of power. And one of the reasons that I've always been interested in the abuse of children is because it is a gross violation of power of one person who has resources and physical strength and knowledge and money and someone else who doesn't. And the kind of person who could take advantage of somebody with so little privileges and claims to themselves, and what kind of and what the child is left with after that, how he or she begins to construct a life after that. You know, I once read this very good Q&A with John Waters, and he said something very simple. They were talking about pedophiles, and he said, "No one chooses to be a pedophile." He said, I can't support them because." But no one chooses it. And he said, they ruin children's dreams. And I thought that was such a simple and brilliant way of putting it, that you know, when a child is traumatized, their dreams are ruined. And it can take a very long time, and sometimes never, for you to give yourself the right to dream again.
New York City is the setting of A Little Life and To Paradise as well. Do you choose New York City as the setting first, or does it just come naturally as you are writing and coming up with the story?
Can you raise your hand so I can see where you are? I can't quite see.
Oh,
okay, thank you, thanks. Sorry, you just said, ahead in front of you. I always say this and people always laugh, but it's really true. Like, I don't like New York very much. I live there. At this point, it just seems easier to stay and complain than to get up and leave, you know? I mean, people who live there are champion complainers. You know, you have a lot of people from here hanging around. It is a city, and I will say this for New York. It is a city where people for centuries have gone to test their mettle, and because they're ambitious or because they're on the run or because they want a new family. And so you do have, you know, what tourists think of as that sort of energy, that crackle in the air is everyone in a race against themselves. And that makes for some great friction and some really tense moments. And for a lot of sorrow. And it is a place where, you know, the first thing you hear when you move to New York is you got here 10 years too late, which is not only not helpful, but not true. You know, I mean, at various points in history, people have proclaimed New York dead and it's over and no one's going to come here anymore. And that's simply not true. The big difference is that, you know, I mean, I have friends who say things like, well, you know, young people don't go out anymore. And it's like, of course they do, you're just not invited. You know, I mean, there are many, many different New Yorks, and depending on where you are in New York and how old you are, or how rich you are, or, you know, what race you are, you're experiencing one New York or another. But New York itself, as this promised place, always exists.
Yeah, it's sort of the myopia of ego there, looking back.
Okay, so... I know that with the people in the trees, which I just, it like baffled me, but I loved it. The science was important and there was a lot of effort to make sure that was right. And I remember watching I think it was at MIT, a panel that you did where you discussed how it's important when writing fiction to try to get certain things in the real world or in real time correct to kind of ground that, to ground the fake story that you're telling, because if you don't, you lose the emotional traction. So I was wondering, with this book, I was surprised that two Americas were completely of your own imagination. So I guess my question is twofold. A, did it feel like world building or not really? And then B, did you find yourself struggling to keep the emotional stakes high or did it just kind of come naturally?
Yeah, I mean, the world building is the most fun part because you can take all sorts of liberties, and as long as it remains consistent within the world you're building, you can sort of do whatever you want. But at the heart of all of these books and at the heart of all of these Americas are very simple stories about characters who want to be loved. And, I think that to go back to China, I remember when I first went there, it was 1999 probably, or 98. At any rate, it was, you know, quite late and things had already begun to change, but it was nowhere near what it is today. And I went to Beijing with one of my very good friends. And, you know, we had been raised, as I mentioned, in the Tiananmen age. We had a very specific idea of what China was, and many of my friends who were first or second generation Chinese American had parents who had come from Hong Kong or Taiwan and already did not think very warmly about the PRC, as we called it, the People's Republic of China, to distinguish from the other two. And I remember what I was most struck by was that it was, you know, as I said, it was still very cold. Beijing was still coming into modernity in many ways. And my friend and I were walking. Everyone was sort of dressed in these puffy gray Mao-like jackets. There was no makeup. There were no billboards. There's nothing luxury. And yet these two girls came by me and they had their arms linked and they were eating, you know, candied apples and giggling. And I just remember thinking that maybe what I had learned in school about what this country was wrong. That here was life being lived and girls gossiping and eating candy and being friends. And this country that I had been taught was one way was on the streets perhaps another. And that little detail, that reminded me that no matter what a regime is or what a state is, that there are people trying to make friends and to be loved and to gossip and have a suite remains the same. And that was a very good reminder throughout the writing of this book.
Hello.
Hi.
My question is that does this address or the building connecting three fiction fictional stories is so tangible? Is there a story behind it, or did you go inside the building? What the historical of it influenced it?
Yeah, so the building is 13 Washington Square North, which is actually NYU faculty housing for their School of Social Work. And when I was researching this, I called up and I said, can I go in? And they said no. And you know, there's actually no door in 13 Washington Square North. It's you enter from the building next door. But it did seem, you know, I have a lot of romance about certain New York buildings. Again, compared to, you know, other cities in other parts of the world, New York is not that old. But I think you always have the sense of how many times a residence has changed hands, and how it once was the grand house of a rich family, and then it probably became divided into apartments, and then it became at some point NYU housing. That the house itself, the building itself, is completely changeable and fungible in a sense. But it is the way that it's interpreted and the metaphor that it becomes in the era that gives it its meaning. Thank you.
Anya, thank you. Thanks everyone for coming.
Thank
Please
you so much.
Please a round of applause.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.